It won't stand.
The summer sun made blotches of fire on the windows of the city and glittering sparks in the dust of the streets. Columns of heat shimmered through the air, rising from the roofs to the white page of the calendar. The calendar's motor ran on, marking off the last days of June.
It won't stand, people said. When they run the first train on the John Galt line, the rail will split. They'll never get to the bridge. If they do, the bridge will collapse under the engine.
From the slopes of Colorado, freight trains rolled down the track of the Phoenix Durango north to Wyoming and the main line of Taggart Transcontinental, south to New Mexico and the main line of the Atlantic Southern. Strings of tank cars went radiating in all directions from the Wyatt oil fields to industries in distant states. No one spoke about them. To the knowledge of the public, the tank trains moved as silently as rays, and as rays, they were noticed only when they became the light of electric lamps, the heat of furnaces, the movement of motors. But as such, they were not noticed. They were taken for granted. The Phoenix Durango Railroad was to end operations on July 25th.
Hank Reardon is a greedy monster, people said. Look at the fortune he's made. Has he ever given anything in return? Has he ever shown any sign of social conscience? Money, that's all he's after. He'll do anything for money. What does he care if people lose their lives when his bridge collapses?
The Taggarts have been a band of vultures for generations, people said.
It's in their blood.
Just remember that the founder of that family was Nat Taggart, the most notoriously antisocial scoundrel that ever lived, who bled the country white to squeeze a fortune for himself. You can be sure that a Taggart won't hesitate to risk people's lives in order to make a profit. They bought inferior rail because it's cheaper than steel. What do they care about catastrophes and mangled human bodies after they've collected the fares?
People said it because other people said it.
They did not know why it was being said and heard everywhere. They did not give or ask for reasons.
Reason, Dr. Pritchett had told them, is the most naive of all superstitions.
The source of public opinion, said Claude Slagenhoff in a radio speech. There is no source of public opinion. It is spontaneously general. It is a reflex of the collective instinct of the collective mind.
Orrin Boyle gave an interview to Globe, the news magazine with the largest circulation. The interview was devoted to the subject of the grave social responsibility of metallurgists, stressing the fact that metal performed so many crucial tasks where human lives depended on its quality.
One should not, it seems to me, use human beings as guinea pigs in the launching of a new product, he said.
He mentioned no names.
Why, no, I don't say that that bridge will collapse, said the chief metallurgist of Associated Steel on a television program. I don't say it at all. I just say that if I had any children, I wouldn't let them ride on the first train that's going to cross that bridge. But it's only a personal preference, nothing more, just because I'm overly fond of children.
I don't claim that the Reardon-Taggart contraption will collapse, wrote Bertram Scudder in the future. Maybe it will and maybe it won't. That's not the important issue. The important issue is, what protection does society have against the arrogance, selfishness, and greed of two unbridled individualists whose records are conspicuously devoid of any public-spirited actions? These two apparently are willing to stake the lives of their fellow men on their own conceited notions about their powers of judgment against the overwhelming majority opinion of recognized experts. Should society permit it? If that thing does collapse, won't it be too late to take precautionary measures? Won't it be like locking the barn after the horse has escaped? It has always been the belief of this column that certain kinds of horses should be kept bridled and locked on general social principles.
A group that called itself Committee of Disinterested Citizens collected signatures on a petition demanding a year's study of the John Galt line by government experts before the first train were allowed to run. The petition stated that its signers had no motive other than a sense of civic duty. The first signatures were those of Balfe Eubank and Mort Liddy. The petition was given a great deal of space and comment in all the newspapers. The consideration it received was respectful, because it came from people who were disinterested. No space was given by the newspapers to the progress of the construction of the John Galt line. No reporter was sent to look at the scene. The general policy of the press had been stated by a famous editor 5 years ago. "There are no objective facts," he had said. "Every report on facts is only somebody's opinion. It is therefore useless to write about facts." A few businessmen thought that one should think about the possibility that there might be commercial value in Reardon metal. They undertook a survey of the question. They did not hire metallurgists to examine samples, nor engineers to visit the site of construction. They took a public poll. 10,000 people, guaranteed to represent every existing kind of brain, were asked the question, "Would you ride on the John Galt line?" The answer overwhelmingly was, "No siree." No voices were heard in public in defense of Reardon metal, and nobody attached significance to the fact that the stock of Taggart Transcontinental was rising on the market, very slowly, almost furtively. There were men who watched and played safe. Mr. Moen bought Taggart stock in the name of his sister. Ben Neely bought it in the name of a cousin. Paul Larkin bought it under an alias. "I don't believe in raising controversial issues," said one of these men. "Oh, yes, of course. The construction is moving on schedule," said James Taggart, shrugging, to his board of directors. "Oh, yes, you may feel full confidence. My dear sister does not happen to be a human being, but just an internal combustion engine. So one must not wonder at her success." When James Taggart heard a rumor that some bridge girders had split and crashed, killing three workmen, he leaped to his feet and ran to his secretary's office, ordering him to call Colorado. He waited, pressed against the secretary's desk, as if seeking protection. His eyes had the unfocused look of panic. Yet his mouth moved suddenly into almost a smile, and he said, "I'd give anything to see Henry Reardon's face right now." When he heard that the rumor was false, he said, "Thank God." But his voice had a note of disappointment. "Oh, well," said Philip Reardon to his friends, hearing the same rumor, "maybe he can fail, too, once in a while. Maybe my great brother isn't as great as he thinks." "Darling," said Lillian Reardon to her husband, "I fought for you yesterday, at a tea where the women were saying that Dagny Taggart is your mistress." "Oh, for heaven's sake, don't look at me like that. I know it's preposterous, and I gave them hell for it. It's just that those silly bitches can't imagine any other reason why a woman would take such a stand against everybody for the sake of your metal. Of course, I know better than that. I know that the Taggart woman is perfectly sexless and doesn't give a damn about you. And, darling, I know that if you ever had the courage for anything of that sort, which you haven't, you wouldn't go for an adding machine in tailored suits. You'd go for some blonde, feminine chorus girl." "Oh, but Henry, I'm only joking. Don't look at me like that." "Dagny," James Taggart said miserably, "what's going to happen to us? Taggart Transcontinental has become so unpopular." Dagny laughed, in enjoyment of the moment, any moment, as if the undercurrent of enjoyment was constant within her, and little was needed to tap it. She laughed easily, her mouth relaxed and open. Her teeth were very white against her sun-scorched face. Her eyes had the look, acquired in open country, of being set for great distances. On her last few visits to New York, he had noticed that she looked at him as if she did not see him.
"What are we going to do? The public is so overwhelmingly against us."
"Jim, do you remember the story they tell about Nat Taggart? He said that he envied only one of his competitors, the one who said, 'The public be damned.' He wished he had said it." In the summer days and in the heavy stillness of the evenings of the city, there were moments when a lonely man or woman, on a park bench, on a street corner, at an open window, would see in a newspaper a brief mention of the progress of the John Galt line, and would look at the city with a sudden stab of hope. They were the very young, who felt that it was the kind of event they longed to see happening in the world, or the very old, who had seen a world in which such events did happen. They did not care about railroads. They knew nothing about business. They knew only that someone was fighting against great odds and winning. They did not admire the fighter's purpose. They believed the voices of public opinion. And yet when they read that the line was growing, they felt a moment's sparkle and wondered why it made their own problems seem easier.